Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
Well, I've decided to decline the offer of tenure. I will not be teaching on the faculty of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's a very difficult decision, not a decision I wanted to make. And instead, I'm going to be the inaugural night chair in race and journalism at Howard University.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the 1619 Project, Nicole Hannah-Jones. She was explaining to CBS This Morning anchor Gail King about why she did not accept tenure at her alma mater, the University of North Carolina. Instead, she's coming to Howard University. Also coming to the Mecca this year, critically acclaimed author Ta-Nehisi Coates. These latest developments, part of the recent surge of popularity for historically black colleges and universities. But what is behind that surge? We have a lot to talk about tonight. My guests are Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of Afro-American Studies here at Howard University, and Rizikat Okidei, Black culture expert and adjunct professor at Bowie State University, another great HBCU. Lines are open if you want to join this conversation. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Carr and Kat, how are you both?
Good.
Wonderful. Good. Wonderful. Wonderful. Before I get into this conversation, because there is a lot to discuss, I really want to start with another part of that interview that we heard with Nicole Hannah-Jones and Gail King, because King asked her about her decision to come to Howard University. And she did kind of a deep dive, and I would love to hear your reaction to this.
Yeah, you know, I have been very, very thoughtful about my decision to go to an historically black college. And what I decided is, since the second grade, when I started being bused into white schools, I've spent my entire life proving that I belonged in elite white spaces that were not built for black people. And I just decided, you know, I got a lot of clarity through what happened with the University of North Carolina. I decided I didn't want to do that anymore, that black professionals should feel free and actually perhaps an obligation to go to our own institutions and bring our talents and resources to our own institutions and help to build them up as well.
Rizikat, you first, when you heard that, and I think this is, you know, rather particular to you because you did not start out at an HBCU. You went to the University of Maryland. You are now at Bowie State University. Talk to me about that dynamic as it relates to what Nicole Hannah-Jones just said.
Sure. First, I have to say, Dr. Carr, I am such a fan. It's such an honor to be in the same space with you tonight. So I had to at least say that because I was super geeked when I found out you were going to be on the show.
He's a bad man now.
Yes, he is.
I appreciate that, my colleague. We work in the same craft, so it's an honor to be here with you as well. And I'm glad we're having this conversation. People need to hear what you're about to say. Harold, watch this.
I want to clarify a couple things. One, I am full-time at Prince George's Community College. I love teaching at Community College. It's been one of the greatest sort of decisions I made to teach there. So I am teaching at what I would term a predominantly black school, but it's not a historically black college or university. I do adjunct at Bowie State, and I have spent most of my undergrad was at University of Maryland College Park. I did my master's at The Ohio State University. So I have a very, as a student, I have a very PWI experience. When I watched the interview that Ms. Hannah-Jones had with Gail King, I was completely floored. I loved her decision. I thought it was the right decision. I do think that, I think there was a hope. I think we all had a hope that somehow things would be better and that these conflicts wouldn't be happening. But with someone with her credibility, with as much as she has done, to have to fight this fight in this very public and very sinister way. When she said that and she searched her heart and she felt it was her obligation, I felt like ancestors were like, yeah, that's exactly what you do. Because there's a long history, and Dr. Carr is a historian, he can attest to this. There's a long history of that's what you do. You get your education and you take what you've learned and you go back to your communities and you teach there. So for me, it was a powerful moment. And I also love that she didn't let anybody know except for that one person at UNC and was like, yeah, I'm doing this. I loved that announcement was made with another black woman sitting opposite for her. So there were so many things about that moment that I absolutely love. But I think her decision in this climate with what's happening was right in line with what our ancestors would want us to be doing at this point, making sure that we're reaching back and taking care of our communities.
Dr. Carr, same question, you know, particularly as it relates to your own, educational journey.
Well, like Professor Okidey, I have a degree from Ohio State University. I have too. I have a JD and a master's, and I taught there. In fact, most Research 1 and Research 2 institutions, Howard's the Research 2, the majority of those classes are taught by adjuncts, are taught by graduate students and non-tenure track people. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to give it to you straight, no chaser. Number one, if UNC had acted right in January, we wouldn't be having this conversation. My friend Nicole Hannah-Jones would be at the University of North Carolina. Number two, we often talk about these things without knowing what we're talking about. So this is obviously good publicity and their benefits and all this, but most people celebrating have very little idea what faculty do, particularly at HBCU. Neither Nicole or my friend Ta-Nehisi Coates will be teaching in the classroom the way people think they know HBCUs by watching A Different World. Number three, these hires illuminate existing tensions. The idea that anyone or two or three or 10 or 100 for that matter will be descending upon HBCUs from white-facing celebrity to somehow build them up really reveals like a bolt of lightning for a split second, and the adjuncts have done a good job at Howard illuminating this, the deep class divides at black colleges, which I would contend since the end of American apartheid in the 60s have basically been scurrying about for a post-Jim Crow identity, are revealing the intra-class tensions between faculty and administration and the distinction between universities. The schools that Kat is teaching about are teaching that. And by the way, because of COVID, that's the last thing I said initially, because of COVID, the entire landscape has changed, except higher ed administrators don't know it yet. If they get this 2 years of free community college through, this whole thing is going to change. And we're talking about now the people who went out and protested in the streets that the petty bourgeois are now benefiting from. This is what we're basically talking about. But Howard is different than Morehouse and Spelman, which are colleges. And the public HBCUs, almost all of whom, which are in the South, that don't have the resources. So I think this hire, these two hires, the most important thing about them is they might spark a serious conversation. But in terms of public-facing celebrity hires, I don't, let's just wait and see.
Well, but to that point, though, and this goes back, to what Riza Kat was just saying, you did not just become brilliant yesterday. You have always been a highly regarded scholar, very popular here at Howard University. Why are you here when you could go anywhere?
Because, unlike a few others, I made a deliberate choice, as did Kat. We made deliberate choices from the beginning. And yes. So we have to talk about the language evaluation. Mm-hmm. Like, what was at the school? And I'm not alone. When you talk to me, you talk to Kat, you talk to all of our colleagues at the HBCUs around this country, the thousands of faculty, many of us made deliberate choices. And at moments like this, what has been particularly striking for me is the invisibility of the faculty, as if we were just sitting around waiting for people to come and somehow elevate the character, the temperament, the ability of the faculty, when in fact that's not the case. And Ta-Nehisi and Nicole would not embrace that narrative. They wouldn't say that's what they're doing. But no, I chose to be. But I must say, the disrespect for faculty at HBCUs is not unique. Disrespect for faculty is a thing in academia, but there is a particular type of way black people do each other when it comes to disrespect.
Yeah, and I'm going to drill down a little bit more about that choice piece, Dr. Carr. But our number is 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the surge in popularity of HBCU, certainly here at Howard University, too. High-profile hires. Certainly, the Vice President of the United States graduated from Howard University, and for a great many people across this country, as they begin to look into the background of, you know, of Vice President Kamala Harris, who had never heard of HBCUs, didn't know what Howard University was, this has opened the door to a lot of eyes and a lot of information, not just about Howard, but HBCUs across the country. Something to think about. Let me go to the phone lines. Robert, calling from Columbia. Thanks for hanging on, Robert. What's on your mind?
So I want to laud both of the speakers. Congratulations on this talk, because it's really hot. I teach in social work at the University of Albany in the School of Public Health and Social Work, and this, my folks went to Howard, and I went to Xavier as an undergraduate student. And so first thing I want to say is the popularity of the faculty, the new faculty coming, I think in some ways, I just don't want to lose sight of the fact Howard has been Howard for more than 150 years. We think about Mordecai Johnson, who kind of formulated the modern notion of the university. So Howard's been an esteemed place for a long time. The rest of the world is picking up on it. Good for them, I guess. This idea about faculty not being treated well at both HBCUs and other places, I think that's a really tough conversation that we need to have that we don't often have. And to the point about public schools versus Howard or Morehouse and Spelman, it's those cash infusions that made the difference for those places. So I'm grateful that the conversation is happening, and I'm looking forward to listening to more. Thanks.
Robert, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319. We are talking about HBCUs and the big news that acclaimed author Ta-Nehisi Coates coming to Howard University. Also, Nicole Hannah-Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the 1619 Project. If you have a comment, if you have a question about that, give us a call. So, Dr. Carr, you said that you made the choice to teach at an HBCU, but what was behind that conscious decision? No pun intended.
Right. Well, no, I don't assume that race is consciousness. That's an important point, Harold, you're making. And so I went to a HBCU. I went to a state HBCU, Tennessee State in Nashville. In terms of my class perspective, first generation students, I knew how important it was, and I know how important HBCUs are, and I wanted to give back. Not even give back. I wanted to extend. And when I came to Howard, I was fortunate. Ron Walters was still, you know, around, and so many others, Eleanor Traylor, so many others. That faculty who really came of age during the Black University movement, and that was really a movement in many ways HBCUs have lost. In other words, my commitment is to the Black community. If Howard closed tomorrow, I would continue at another Black school. But these hires, these recent hires, reflect a valuation more, I think, aspirational. Howard functions in the classroom like an HBCU, like any other HBCU. But in terms of a luxury brand, it operates closer to like Ivy League and Ivy adjacent places like NYU.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that what we have to understand, and Robert really nailed it coming out of Xavier, is that these historically Black schools are responsible for helping to train, not only, and we always talk about we're training leaders. No, what we're training is servants. But in this contemporary climate, when higher education is getting ready to collapse, quite frankly, it's going to be restructured. Some of the schools like Howard, Morehouse, and Spelman would be fine, but the Albany States, you know, some of the Stillmans and you know, the Oakwoods are going to be threatened with being consumed in a higher ed culture where we're basically talking about undergraduates coming for branding and networks. And what I'm terribly afraid of is that if we get into this whole celebrity culture of faculty who won't be teaching now, let me emphasize that, we run the risk of basically losing a very important anchoring foundation of what the purpose is as historically black colleges.
An excellent point. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the popularity of HBCUs, a surge that we've seen in recent years, not recent months, recent years. And this goes beyond the acquisition of celebrity black intelligentsia and the like. We're talking about a surge in enrollment that we've seen not just at Howard, but we've seen it like my alma mater, Morgan State University. We've seen at Bowie State University, and we've seen these places such as Morehouse and Fisk and the like. We're going to drill down a little bit more about this. What is behind it? How can this continue? So please stay with us. You do not want to miss out on this conversation. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2. Please don't forget to download the app on your smartphone, and you can hear this program live in its entirety. And, of course, 98.3 FM. If you're on the phone, that includes Paul calling from D.C., Nivi calling from Maryland. Hang on. We will get your phone calls. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking about the surge in popularity of HBCUs, certainly this coming to even more notoriety with the acquisition of two high-profile journalists, great big black brains. There's no other way to put it. Nicole Hannah-Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of the 1619 Project, and Ta-Nehisi Coates, critically acclaimed author. My guests are Dr. Greg Carr, Chair of Afro-American Studies here at Howard University, and Rizikat Okideyi. She's a black culture expert, adjunct professor at Bowie State University, and full-time professor at Prince George's Community College. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Okay, Kat, let me put you on the spot.
Yep.
You went to the University of Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Great school. No shade. Okay.
Okay.
And then you went to Ohio State. I used to work in Columbus.
Yes.
Ohio State University, the biggest employer in the state of Ohio. Yes.
It's huge.
It is. I mean, back in the 90s, when I was at Channel 4 in Columbus, Ohio, there were more than 60,000 employees. That's a city unto itself.
It is.
You know, college football powerhouse, you know, and the like. But so why didn't you at least try to get the HBCU experience after leaving the University of Maryland?
Okay, that's a great question. So one, I actually applied to, just for a timeline, I grew up in Florida. So when I graduated from high school, I was living in Florida. My mother wanted me to go to Howard. My Nigerian mother was like, I want you to go as far away from Florida as possible. So one of the schools that I applied to was Howard University. To this day, I still don't understand what happened. They sent me my dorm stuff, but they never sent me my acceptance letter, so I didn't know if I was in. And we were trying to find out and call, and we couldn't figure it out. So the day that I was actually leaving for University of Florida, which is the first school I went to, they sent me my acceptance letter. It was the weirdest thing. So I had already made that decision for undergrad. When it came to graduate school, because I wanted to study with Kaiser Jewell, who was at The Ohio University, or at least I thought she was at The Ohio University at the time, I chose to go there. The African and African-American studies program there at the time was it had some things there that I really wanted to experience. Now, I'll say this, even though I went to three PWIs, once I became an Afro-Am major, most of my professors were Black professors. And so I had this interesting sort of inside an egg sort of experience where I'm at a PWI and I'm part of a, you know, a largely marginalized community of students who are there. And at the same time, because of my major, I'm getting the benefit of having Black professors in the core of my classes. So there was this weird sort of back and forth where I was constantly aware that I was on a white campus, but I had this home away from home with the Black community that was there. And when the time came, I went to the school that gave me money and had, you know, I wanted to study under K.C. Jewell, so that's where I went.
But let me say this, and I am not in any way, shape, or form trying to take away from your educational experience. You have more education than I do, and you've got a big brain, which is why we constantly have you on this program. But, you know, let me say, you know, my father went to Howard, the first person in my entire family to go to college. My mother went to D.C. Teachers College, both of those HBCUs, D.C. Teachers College now, UDC. I went to Morgan State, okay, in Baltimore. My daughter graduated from Howard. Some people would say, you know, my daughter's now third generation HBCU. And so as it relates to that, folks could say as it relates to, you know, my family or specifically me and as it relates to education, oh, well, you're black. And understanding that there are great African-American studies programs at PWIs and what have you, but you don't have the quad at Ohio State. Howard. You don't.
Let me be clear. Socially, it was a terrible experience.
That's my point, because it's not just the education of HBCUs. You don't have, you know, if you go to Morgan, somebody says meet you on the bridge. There are three bridges now, but we know which one you're talking about. If you're talking about, I think it's the bowl at North Carolina Central, we know where to meet, you know. And so the HBCU experience is not just about, you know, the degree that you get, but it is about the holistic experience. Something that we used to say here way back in the day at WHUR, 365 degrees of Blackness.
This is true. But I will say this. There is something that happens when you are a Black person at a PWI. The community that you create there is also, like, we had our own community. We named things, like, when I was at University of Florida, there was, like, it escapes me as I'm talking to you, but there was a specific space that when you said it as a Black student, you knew exactly where it was. Like, you figure out your own language and you create your own community. So I do, yes, there are things that are definitely, you know, that you definitely missed out on. But I do think that you create something else in its place when you don't go to an HBCU. Like, that's what we did. And I think anybody who's been to a PWI can attest to that. Like, you find your space, you find your home, you find those few Black teachers that, you know, Roberta Coates at University of Maryland College Park was an amazing mentor. She was this fly Black woman who went there in the 60s, who, you know, was there, you know, on campus, you know, during some of the riots and the upsets, and she had stories for days. And you knew that you could go to her if you needed her and she could help you. So you did find, I was able to create a home for myself, even though I knew I was in, you know, what was a very tenable situation at times, being at a, you know, being a Black person at a white school. So, yeah, so you're right. But, and there are, we figure it out. You know, we will figure it out. We'll find a way to create our own community.
Well, I'm so glad that you came on back home.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I hear you.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Let's go to Nivy. Nivy calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling. Nivy. Thank you. Nivy, I apologize. What's on your mind?
Yes. Can you all hear me?
Go right ahead.
Yes. I wanted to co-sign on that. I went to a PWI myself. And we did find, you know, we did have to work hard to find culture within amongst the African American community. And my whole family went to HBCUs, and I was the only one that went to PWI. But I really wanted to comment on some of the stuff that was said earlier about faculty not being appreciated in HBCUs. I also wanted to comment on just in general, I'm enjoying this conversation, really getting a lot of nuggets. But my critical question is, where do we see enrollment increasing at HBCUs? What does that mean for those PWIs who are now making a strong push to be more inclusive in the areas of diversity, equity, and racism and reconciliation?
Dr. Carr, that's a great question. I'll let you chime in on that.
Well, Nadia, say very quickly, number one, enrollment is not increasing at all HBCUs. The class divide is being exposed. So the smaller schools, the state HBCUs where the budgets are being squeezed by these southern legislatures that are squeezing all higher ed budgets, are faced with real economic structural crisis. And COVID has just revealed those things. Ohio State, and as you say, and it's interesting, Prof, when I was there in African Studies with Nick Nelson and Linda Myers and Manny Merrill, Jay Sue Jewell was there at the time, Shirley Turner, remember Miss Shirley, and E.K. Nielsen and all them.
Oh,
and I
went
to the Frankie L. Black Culture Center. I was a graduate assistant there.
Oh, yeah.
Black students at HWCUs, as I call them, they have access to resources that you don't have at many HBCUs. And, you know, it's very different when you go to a school than when you return or come to a school as a faculty member. Most undergraduates have no idea what faculty go through, black faculty, at places like our HBCUs. The respect that students have for faculty is very different than the relationship between faculty and administration. So finally, in answer to that question, I think what's going to happen is that these white schools will continue to do what they've done, which is cherry pick for the valedictorians and the people that can run fast. And those will be the black students they will continue to accessorize their white student bodies with in the name of diversity. The HBCUs will continue to be squeezed. And those who are not fortunate enough to be a Howard or a Morehouse or a Spelman, who over the last year have received this kind of Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, white guilt, blood money, are going to struggle to remain afloat because enrollment is not going up at all of our HBCUs.
Nivey, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Paul, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Paul. What's on your mind?
Question is, I went to a HBCU school years ago.
Where did you go?
I went to Howard, and I went to Tuskegee.
Okay.
And I didn't finish. And I'm trying to understand, it's $1 trillion of money coming through our communities that we spend. Why don't HBCU schools offer online courses and degrees and certificates? Because it's a lot of us in the metropolitan area would love to go back to an HBCU school online. That's money. It's all the white universities. They have online courses.
That's a great question. Kat, do you have any thoughts about that?
I can't speak to that. I guess I'm actually quite surprised. I think I assumed that there were online classes available at HBCUs. I didn't know that wasn't the case.
Dr. Carr?
Yeah, Morehouse has just entered a partnership with an education provider that is going to allow folks to take to get several degrees. They debuted, I think, four or five options, mostly business, computer science, I think, is another. Completely online, Paul. And I think that really is the future. I think it is the future. COVID drove us all online and exposed one of the real challenges of historically black colleges across the board, the structural challenge of technological capacity. And Harold, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure.
So, that's right, the infrastructure. And there just has not been that type of investment because they haven't been those dollars. And so, Paul, I think the future of education, period, is really going to involve a deep investment in virtual education. And as a result, HBCUs have a real opportunity. But I'll say this, though, finally, the predators are there. Because if you remember about 15, 20 years ago with Coursera and some of these massive online open courses, Yale, University of Chicago, Harvard, they tried to do it, and it was a little premature. COVID drove us all online, and what I expect is going to happen now, the big fish going to eat the little fish. So the only thing HBCUs can do, if that's the case, is try to produce curriculum and instruction that is singularly unique to compete with those places. And so that's a very serious tidal wave coming our way.
Yeah. I will say, Paul, thank you so much for your phone call. I think you made, you know, such an excellent, you know, point, Dr. Carr, because, you know, we, on several occasions pre-COVID, that was one of the discussions that we had with Dr. Frederick here in this studio when he was talking about, you know, the development of, you know, online courses at Howard University. And COVID changed everything, not just for Howard, but it changed everything for everybody, particularly in, you know, when it came to, you know, to higher education. And as you said, it revealed not just for HBCUs, but for colleges across this country, some of the deficits, the infrastructure deficits, and some of the other issues that, you know, that they've had. But
I mean, as someone that, just to jump in here,
please,
Harold, as someone who teaches online, that is a skill set that is, it's very different.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that people understand online classes, teaching them, being part of them, it actually is a lot more work. And so I do think that when we talk about access to these types of classes, I think it's important to understand that that format is very different. So in addition, when you're moving people on, not everybody can teach online. So you have to find people who know how to not only work the infrastructure that's there to use it, but how to be engaging online, because it's not an easy thing to do.
Absolutely. Excellent point. And to this other issue, what part, Dr. Carr, do you believe high-profile black professors, you know, that, you know, those that have star power, and there are a lot of them, we've seen them, what part does not tenure, but salary, compensation play in whether or not they come to an HBCU or go to a PWI?
Well, I think every individual has to answer that question for themselves. Nicole Hannah-Jones not giving up her job at the New York Times, for example.
Right.
So that tells me that she's not going to be on campus. I don't know. In other words, a lot. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, if you're 18, 19-year-old and think you're going to walk into a class and you're going to see Professor Nicole Hannah-Jones, you're about to be disabused of that notion in August. So, and Ta-Nehisi is a writer in residence. That means, you know, in terms of how that usually works, he comes and goes as he pleases. And, you know, Ta-Nehisi has a deep commitment to Howard. I mean, he too is multi-generational Howard. So I'm not questioning either of my friend's commitment. But, you know, when you have a guy like Cornel West, who, you know, I know, and every time Cornel comes to campus, they ask him, why don't you teach at HBCU? And, you know, he'll wrap his arm around the closest faculty member. I've been that person a couple of times and said, look, you better thank God for these faculty members, because I couldn't come here because I'd have to teach classes and grade papers. And no, I couldn't travel. I couldn't do what I do. And so I think it's an open question as to what these celebrities, and mind you now, this is white-facing celebrity. You know, if you go and ask the regular rank-and-file black person who either these folks are anybody, they're not going to really know, you know, what the impact will be. I'm not sure. And why do they choose to come to this space? I'll tell you one thing. Nicole's bringing her own money.
Yeah.
And so
she's going to be a Knight Fellow. She mentioned some $15 million.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Which means if I were her, you know, the first thing you got to do is probably involve your colleagues. You got to spread some of that around to these people in terms of who are not going to get the type of, make the type of money you make out of that. And then finally, if you start hiring celebrity black people to come because you're basically renting a brand, if they're not going to be teaching and grading papers and doing that kind of stuff, and you draw their salaries out of the operating budget of the university, there's the potential for a war with the faculty, beginning with the adjuncts, who are the great unpaid labor force of academia, and continuing through the tenure track faculty. But particularly if you're bringing them in as full professors.
Right.
And to that point, you mentioned Cornell, you know, West. One of the things that, and this is, you know, and this is news from, you know, last week, he had a highly public resignation from Harvard University's Divinity School just last week, saying in a public letter that Harvard is in a state of decline and decay and spiritual rot. Now, he is returning to Union Theological Seminary in New York. He was there about 40 years ago. And while that is not certainly, you know, it's not an HBCU, but to that point, talk to me about the importance of respect, you know, Kat, when you are teaching, whether you are an adjunct or, you know, whether you are a fully tenured professor, and then you too, Dr. Carr.
I think it's, you know, it's with any of these situations, nobody wants to be in situations where they're putting all of their labor and their love into something and they're not getting respected. I read Dr. West's resignation letter, and, you know, that, you know, there are some things there that I'm just like, okay, I get it. Like, I understand why he's left, I think, for the second time now. I do think, though, there is a space where, and, you know, Dr. Carr is bringing up some really good points around how the celebrityism plays into things. He has done the work. So why he doesn't have tenure, I don't understand. I know for a lot of people, tenure is this sign of achievement that, you know, when you get it, it's not about just guaranteeing you, you know, job security, but it's also about saying that you have an institutional home. So when you have done all this work and it's not being recognized and you are not feeling like you're being treated fairly, he has the option to go. There are a lot of professors that don't. Mm-hmm. I know professors who called up for tenure who deserve tenure and who were denied for some random reason or the other. They don't know why, and they don't necessarily have the ability to leave. But I think the commercialization of higher education has turned an ugly head. You, as a professor, it is not unusual for a student to say, because I'm paying tuition, I'm paying this salary. And I'm like, that's not really how that works, but, you know, go off if you need to. Get it out so we can, you know, have a real conversation. And this idea that because you're paying tuition that, you know, me wanting to teach is not necessary. Just give me my answers. Tell me what I need to do, and then we'll go on about things. So for a lot of those Black professors, I do think the idea of coming to an institution where you don't have to necessarily code switch, where, you know, you don't have to worry about somebody, you know, looking at your outfit kind of crazy, where you don't have to worry about, you know, walking this fine line all the time, could feel like a reprieve. And it could feel like I'm going to be appreciated here. Now, Dr. Carr is raising some very important issues that, you know, do need to be discussed, because I have been a long-term adjunct and I've worked full-time. And as an adjunct, I mean, there are a lot of schools that if it were not for adjunct faculty, the school would, the departments would not function. And mm-hmm. So that question about, okay, when you bring these folks in, what happens? I know that Ms. Hannah Jones is actually bringing in money with her. I don't know how that money works. I don't understand that part. But I do know she's bringing in money. So I was like, bet, let's see how that, you know, bring the money. You know, let's get Howard what it needs. Because I, you know, as someone who has lots of Howard friends, one of the things that you always hear about is the need for alma mater to give back. For these schools, in order to, you know, to survive, they need their alma mater to support and give back. And, you know, if that's not happening, that's also contributing to whether or not they can, you know, stay open. So the respecting is always going to be important. Like, nobody's going through all of this schooling just to be treated like, you know, flim-flam. You know, people want their respect. And in higher education, tenure is one of those signs of respect. It's one of those signs of achievement. And so for those people for whom that is important, that is something that they work for. And when they don't get it, it's a really cool slap in the face. By the time I got to the Ohio State University, I didn't find out till later that Casey Jewell wasn't, there was an issue. She wasn't there, you know? These things are important, especially when you tell professors and, you know, as scholars that they have to research and they have to prove their worth with their research, and they can't just rest on their laurels, and then when they do all of this work and then there's nothing in return, or it's just some sad little note, or, you know, people have to make noise before you get what you deserve, it can feel really off-putting. So I don't blame folks for wanting to leave at all.
I will say, having done the adjunct thing at my alma mater for two semesters, and I think you make a really good point that not so much, you know, the respect, but because I was pulled in, you know, not because of you know, my multiple degrees,
right?
Because I only have one, but and that's what the chair of arts and science said to me back then, back in 2001. When he asked me to come in, I said, I don't have a master's degree. He said, yeah, but you've already have 20 years of experience. You have more experience, in television and radio than any professor on the faculty.
That's right.
So that, you know, that was great. That was the thing that convinced me. But then you do have to deal with, okay, which class am I in this week?
Right.
And, you know, do I have enough chairs, and is this projector running because I don't have an office? And
right.
And yeah, I get it. You're talking 2001. There was no internet as we know it. And, you know, having students call me on my phone and I'm grading papers, and Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah.
In addition to doing a 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. television morning show 5 days a week.
Right.
So.
That's right.
But the balance is being able to share this major thing, which is my cultural competency.
Mm-hmm.
To talk to students who look like me, who come from similar backgrounds, where... I don't know, because I've never taught at, never attended a PWI. So, Kat, you can tell me, but I know at an HBCU, there are times when you stand in front of a classroom and you can say, look a here.
Right.
When you can't do that at PWIs, and you can teach that culturally competent black history lesson, even if it's the black personal history that comes along with that $115 textbook that you are scraping money together to afford, that you may or may not crack open. So I think that the value, whether we will see, you know, Hannah Jones in a classroom, but the chance that I am sure, whether she's grading papers or not, I'm sure that the students will have an opportunity to hear her lecture once, twice, five times. I know that's going to happen. I think it would be a waste if to have this great mind here and not have the students, and faculty for that matter, have that experience. The same with, you know, with Coates.
This really kind of, again, it touches a bit of a nerve, because I think of Judy Moore Latta.
Oh, yeah.
I think of, you know, and I think of you, Harold, with 20 years of experience. When a student gets you at a Morgan State, they're getting somebody who is not only going to help them reach their dreams, but has the practical ability to give them and help them learn the skills to do that. I think one of the dangers of celebrity faculty is, again, the idea that the work, the value they bring is somehow an enhancement of the value that was already there.
Mm.
And people may know the name Nicole Hannah Jones and not know the name Judy Moore Latta. And if you don't know the name Judy Moore Latta, then you don't know the name Nicole Hannah Jones, because if there's not a Judy Moore Latta, there's not a Nicole Hannah Jones. And so I guess, and I'm not saying that to denigrate, but I guess what I'm saying is, and Kat, you know this, Okadeyi, you know, when you practice the craft of teaching, it is you're not doing it for the respect, quite frankly. You're doing it because it is an obligation. And I really think that what we're about to see is a structural transformation in higher education that's going to lay bare the fact that many of these quote-unquote elite schools are basically, in the words of Scott Galloway, hedge funds with classes for the children of the investors, with a few freakishly intelligent poor people sprinkled in so they can disguise the fact that that's what they are. And if that's what Howard is aspiring to, God bless him. But that's not why I came to the HBCU, brother.
Right.
And
teaching is a calling, because everybody, it's not for everybody. I will tell you that I absolutely love interacting with my students. I love watching their brains spin. I love forcing them to come up with ideas that, you know, are kind of pulled from everything that they've experienced in addition to what they've read. So I stay because I love working with the students that I get to work with. And I specifically love working at a community college because I get to work with some of my best students have been like way older than me, and they have all of this knowledge that they bring into the classroom. And it's amazing. I get excited because it's like, oh, this is an amazing mix of folks. So, you know, I think for the teaching aspect, you know, most of the people that I know that were denied tenure are often really good teachers. And like they're really passionate. So when that tenure doesn't come through because their package for whatever reason isn't seen as enough, it slaps. It hits them in the face really hard, you know? And so I do think what Dr. Carr is saying is really important, because we definitely don't want to lose that part. And, you know, I have to say, well, I, as always, I'm learning sitting at the feet of Dr. Carr, because when I read about everything, I really didn't understand. I did think that Hannah Jones was going to be, I didn't expect her to grade papers. I'm not even going to lie. There's going to be grad students. But I figured graduate students would be working directly with her, and they would be able to get that, the benefit of her knowledge. So my assumption was that she would be in the classroom at some point, that it wouldn't just be sort of this, you know, pie in the sky situation.
But
I assume that she will. But as you know, Kat, faculty like that, they don't grade papers.
But
and
let me say, because I'm really low on time, you know, sometimes, you know, this the acquisition of these great minds is what you need to do to get more great minds into the church. And I mean young mind students, so that they can hear the sermon. And I think. You know, the gospel of higher education is well served with these great acquisitions, and I hope there are more. Dr. Greg Carr, Rizik Hat, Okidei, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For talking to us. That is The Daily Drum on this Tuesday, July 20th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.